was an amiable and genial snob.
He was a two-sided person. He could be difficult and rude and unpleasant when something displeased him. And they also know that he could be absolutely enchanting and the greatest fun in the world and one of the kindest men in the world.
He was a fat little man with several chins, and he was not handsome. He was ugly.
I liked him when he was gay. I liked him when he was melancholy. I even liked him when he was insulting and when I rowed with him.
In New York, when I got up one morning about 8 o'clock, at which hour Alec had already been busy writing and telephoning for at least 2 hours, and I walked into the living room where he was thus engaged, and I said to him, "Good morning, Alec. It's a nice day." And Alec replied, "It is not. You're a fool. Shut up. Get out."
He was a personage, what the French call a personage, and he was more of that than he was a writer or even a wit. And he was a good writer, a great storyteller, an almost fabulous wit. But he was above everything, I think, a personage. And Alec said, "That reminds me of Chesterton coming in with a cape something like mine." Chesterton had such a cape as Alex. His companion said, "Mr. Chesterton, does everybody always know who you are?" And Chesterton said, "Well, my dear, if they don't, they ask."
Despise his gifts. But he lived a purely impressionistic sort of life. He knew this, and he overvalued the intellectual lives of the rest of us in the kindest way. He's been written of often as if he were frivolous, but his value was that he saw life as a constant emergency, and he called on all of us to not to fail him and life in this crisis. But of course the person who came least near failing life was Alec Wolcott himself. He left no great work, and what he left will be criticized as sentimental. He praised the old-fashioned virtues, kindliness, giving away money to king if a man stood up and reminded mankind that if they hardened their hearts against kindness and love, they were losing a treasure.
Yes, Alexander?
Or admire so much. To others, my mother may have seemed less beautiful than a certain contemporary of hers named Lillian Russell. Intellectually, she fell short of Madame Curie. Poor dear, she was nowhere near so rich as Hetty Green. True, she had great courage and a most hospitable heart. But the point is, she was mine. So it is in this matter of foster mothers. Harvard is, I believe, more famous. Chicago, larger.
Side straight poker game, which usually continued through the weekend. Ross and I had the parlor floor. Alec and Hawley had two apartments above us. And the top floor was occupied by Kate Ogilby and Bill Powell, Alec's selections, of course, who, of course, had our entire approval, too. Alec insisted that we have open house, and it certainly was as open a house as you can possibly imagine. We were always prepared for 4 extra dinner guests, ostensibly one for each one of us, you see. That rule was pretty elastic, though, for on one Sunday, I remember feeding 30 unexpected guests. For Alec, the only time open house did not apply was when we had our housewarming. We refused to permit his supervision of the guest list, so he announced he just wouldn't come at all. He stuck it out until about 10:30, when he appeared sheepishly and gathered up some of his favorite actresses, repaired to his apartment, and locked the door. Our large gatherings caused the neighborhood to believe that 412 West 47th Street was a new speakeasy. The 47th Street police station was in the next block, and inevitably the law took an interest in us. My male companions were hilarious when a marshal delivered a summons to me. "Let's not raise a finger to help her," was Alec's chivalrous reaction. But Hawley, a kindlier fellow, said his brother-in-law, Lloyd Stryker, the famous lawyer, would go with me to the district attorney's office. It developed that my name was in the book of an arrested bootlegger. I bought all the liquor for the house, and the amount was certainly large enough to be incriminating. Alec just couldn't stand solitude. He and I worked on morning papers, reporting for work at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and Ross did some of his editing at home. But if no one was around, Alec would phone frantically for companions. All morning long, in untidy pajamas, he would sit like a Buddha, tossing out witticisms, some of them good, some awful. But he would chuckle and was delighted at any appreciative listeners. No matter how late he returned home at night, Alec would scour the house for someone to play a game of cribbage or backgammon or casino or anything he wanted to suggest. Alec adored Christmas, and he was usually the one who decorated the community tree, or at least bossed it. He gave much thought to his gifts and was firm about the presents he wanted. One Christmas, he told us we could give him an Oxford English dictionary. Not too much to ask, he said, if a dozen of us would give him each one an alphabetical section. I usually did the legwork for these pranks, so I bought 12 volumes of the letter A, which we all wrapped up separately and elaborately and put under the tree. Alec was keen about amateur theatricals, a holdover from his Hamilton college days. He turned us all into actors, and we rehearsed like mad any skit he wrote. Many of them were really quite good. At first, we limited our performances to our own home. My house, the No-Siree, was presented one Sunday evening before an invited audience. Alec demoted our professional acting friends to the chorus and the orchestra and other menial jobs. We amateurs played the leading parts in skits or songs done by Haywood Broome, Alice Duer Miller, Bob Sherwood, Nisa McMean, Arthur Samuels, and of course, Alec. Kirk, Margalo Gilmore, and Tallulah Bankhead. The No-Siree was such a success that Alec couldn't wait to give another performance.
Hectic youthful years that Jane Grant recalls, and the years that followed, Alexander Wolcott became a familiar figure in the New York scene. When he attended first nights as a critic, he wore a flowing cape, an opera hat, a colorful scarf, and strode down the aisles in flopping galoshes. He was a show-off, but he had another side to his nature.
I met Alexander Wolcott first during World War I. I was stationed in Nantes, France, and he was a sergeant at a base hospital at the little town of Savenay. Someone asked me down to the hospital for the Thanksgiving dinner the personnel were putting on. It was an amazing celebration for an organization of that kind. And I learned that the motivating force was Alexander Wolcott, a young newspaper man and a dramatic critic who was there. I met him that night. He came and lunched with me in Nantes, and we were friends from that day until he died. I don't think I qualify as having been one of the greatest of his friends, because we always spoke. To be a great friend of Wolcott, you usually had to have a gargantuan row with him. He was a desperately unhappy young man as a sergeant at Savenay. He felt that he wasn't doing his part in the war. He hated carrying bedpans as his contribution to the war effort. I remember a sergeant who looked like a very heavy owl.
This is Charles Brackett, a newspaper man, author, scriptwriter, and Hollywood motion picture producer.
Wolcott was the first intimate celebrity America had. I don't think anybody today is loved quite as dearly as he was by the radio listeners of his generation.
I have some aunts in Kentucky who worshipped him from afar. And I'd told them about him, and he'd felt that they were a little bit like his family in the town of Phalanx, New Jersey, where he grew up. A lecturing date took him to Louisville, Kentucky. And suddenly, without any warning, their doorbell was rung, and there stood Alexander Wolcott. He wore a sonic mitten. And eternal delight. He wanted to see, he enchanted them, and he dropped me a note saying, naturally, I called on the aunts when I was in Kentucky.
Even his best friends could not understand Alexander Wolcott. As a child, when he was asked what he wanted to be, a policeman, a fireman, or a motorman, he said, I would rather be a fabulous monster. He almost achieved that ambition and a great deal more. But it's doubtful if anyone ever really knew him.
I can't say whether he was melancholy or happy. I should say he combined both elements in excess more than anyone I ever knew. His eyes were bad, he was enormously heavy, and his nerves were on edge toward the end of his life. He just lived in the public eye too much. I remember one picture of Wolcott with great affection. A group of us had dinner with him beside the casino in Monte Carlo. At that time, there was a dance floor near the place where the tables were set. And suddenly, the little orchestra there began playing the Dance of the Hours. And Wolcott got up and performed the Dance of the Hours for us solo on that dance floor.
One of the most amusing memories I have of Wolcott was seeing him getting shaved. He couldn't shave himself for some reason or other. I think he said it tickled his upper lip or something. So he went to great expense to have a barber drive over from the St. Regis Hotel. And I think his fee was about $5 plus taxi fare, perhaps even more. And since his phone was ringing all the time, Wolcott would be sitting in his bathroom, covered with lather. Bathroom was right next to his study. While he had his valet hopping about answering the telephone, and he would get up in the middle of the shaving operation and answer the phone. He had a secretary working there. He had an extra typist. He had his cook running around, as well as his valet. And I was in there to do some spare research for him.
This is Danton Walker, a well-known columnist and author of several books. He knew Alexander Wolcott well. And after he died, this is what Walker wrote in his newspaper column.
Alexander Wolcott is dead, and a great many things are now being written about him which I believe would amuse him if he were still around to read them. It was to be expected that most of the remarks quoted about him would be the wisecracks of the self-conscious wits of his own circle, and it would be characteristic of Wolcott to sneer at the sentiment and laugh heartily at the jibes. Well, he certainly is at times, but principally because he sets a standard for himself and expects everyone else to live up to it. His prejudice would furnish a field day for a psychoanalyst. Why, for example, should he so dislike Christmas cards?
Wolcott was sentimental, and he liked to recall the past. Millions of people of several generations liked to share his sentimentality. This is his voice on a radio program in 1938, echoing back over almost 20 years.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, Alexander Wolcott.
There are people. This is no longer seriously disputed, even in the academic world. There are people who, at uncertain times and for a short distance only, can see into the future. My eyes, however, are peering in the opposite direction, straining at a task which is not much easier. It's difficult, you think, to look into the future? That's true. But mark you, it's no cinch to look into the past. For reasons of my own, reasons too complicated to crowd into this broadcast, too intimate to state in so public a place. For reasons of my own, I wish to revisit the world I knew when I was 8 years old, a time when more than half of those now listening to me had not yet been even thought of. Have you ever revisited the world as it was when you were 8? The road back is not clearly marked. It may take you a long time to get there. You'll have to go alone. So easy to lose the path, and no one can point the way. All I'm willing to do, all I can do, is suggest one method which some have found effective. The year you were 8 years old, do you recall where you were living then? The town, the street, the house? You do? Very well. Take a quiet hour out of every day in your present life. Shut out the world around you. Close your eyes and go back to that house. Take one room in it. The living room, I should think. Your own, perhaps. Is there a chair in it you remember? Sit in that chair. Look around you. Do you remember where the doors were? The windows? That closet? What was against the wall there? A piano? What hung over it? Can you remember? Try to remember. You can't? Try tomorrow, then. It'll come, bit by bit. As a photographic plate is developed in a dark room, the look, the very smell of that room will emerge from the mists. Then, little by little, sounds will fill the house. You may hear in the hall a long-forgotten voice. Through the chenille portieres will come someone you had not thought of in years. Don't get up. Wait. Wait. Is that your mother's step upon the stairs?
During that broadcast, Alexander Wolcott went on to recall a certain magazine that was a favorite of his in childhood, Harper's Young People. He recalled it because it brought back memories of the time when he was 8 years old, memories of the year 1895.
1895. All manner of sounds and smells can bring that year back to me, can me bring me back to it. The whir of a lawnmower, the sound the cable cars used to make, the clop, clop, clop of hoofbeats on asphalt, the smell of syringa, the scent of new-made bread. I'm back in our living room. It's twilight, and from the veranda of the house opposite comes the sound of young folks, voices. Some of them have long been still. What is that they are singing? Oh, yes. I remember. I don't want to play in your yard. I don't like you anymore. You'll be sorry when you see me sliding down our cellar door. You can't holler down our rain barrel. You can't climb our apple tree. I don't want to play in your yard if you won't be good to me.
Difficult? Yes. Troublesome? Yes. And yet, as Danton Walker said,
no one knows or will know the generous and thoughtful thing he did for friends and certain members of his family, and it is not my place to tell.
This is a biography in sound, an impression of Alexander Wolcott, who called himself a fabulous monster. Regardless of his own epithet for himself, he became famous as a newspaper reporter, a war correspondent, a dramatic critic, a book reviewer, and as the town crier of the air. But 13 years after his death, he is remembered not so much for his accomplishments, but as an individual. An individual who insisted on being himself and following his own path. He had many friends that he kept throughout his lifetime. He had many friendships that were broken. He was loved and hated, honored and despised, often by the very same people.
All the people who knew Alec knew that he was a two-sided person, that he could be difficult and rude and unpleasant when something displeased him. And they also know that he could be absolutely enchanting and the greatest fun in the world and one of the kindest men in the world.
This is Harold Ginsberg, president of the Viking Press. He was Alexander Wolcott's publisher and friend during the years of his greatest success.
And maybe nothing stands out as much in my memory is the fact that it was always fun to be with Alec. You never were bored in any circumstances. There was an enthusiasm there and a vigor that he brought to everything he did, which keyed up and brought out the best in most of the people he was with. My own friendship with him went back to the late 20s, when he was spending a crazy summer in the south of France in the dear old days before the Depression, and he was living with a curious assortment of people in a big villa. There's one episode I remember out of that, that a picture that is unforgettable. In those days, as today, dress, to say the least, was informal on the Riviera. And one night late, after Alec had gone to bed, he decided he really wasn't sleepy and would like to go to the casino to do some gambling. He got up out of bed, put a dressing gown and slippers on over his pajamas and went down to the casino. And he was outraged because they wouldn't let him in. He didn't see why he was dressed any more curiously than most of the other people who were there already. But it was really my publishing relationship with him that was most satisfactory. He was not only the easiest sort of man in the world to do business with, he was modest about his own work. He worked hard at it. He liked it often, but he didn't expect too much from it. When I first published While Rome Burns, he hadn't had much success in the book field. He was only beginning to be a figure of some national renown. And his principal concern was that I shouldn't lose any money. He was very worried that I might be too enthusiastic and might print too much. Print too many copies or too much in advertising the book. Well, of course, that went on to become one of the great sellers of its time. Then later on, when he decided to do his Woolcott Readers, another side of them was of him was shown that was characteristic and not enough known. That was his enormous generosity and enthusiasm for the work of other people that he admired. This was true whether it was writers or actors or singers or anybody. He was a zealous missionary in terms of trying to get his friends and the public to see and hear and read the things that he liked. Many of us thought that his taste was not necessarily the best in the world, but that wasn't important. He was this wonderful enthusiast who, when he liked something, went to work to make other people know about it, went to work to see that the work that he himself admired would get a wide audience, and that all the people he liked, and the public as well, should try it and see whether they didn't agree with him. This was an enormously useful thing to a great many contemporaries. He was responsible for launching or stimulating or enlarging the careers of a great many people in all the fields that engaged his interest.
In his own time, Alexander Woolcott became a legend that was dramatized by his friends George Kaufman and Morse Hart in a play called The Man Who Came to Dinner. The central character was called Sheridan Whiteside and was originally played by Monty Woolley. It was a caricature of Woolcott at his worst. Meddling, insulting, domineering. But he enjoyed it. Later on, as a matter of fact, he played the part himself in road companies. Thus, he achieved his dream of being on the other side of the footlights. But to a degree, he was still Alexander Woolcott.
I knew Alexander Woolcott first through some of his friends. He was a gentleman who liked to know the people who were doing things, and he wanted to know my husband when he was in Albany, and he wanted to know him when he was in Washington. And we found that he was one of the very best of friends. Once he knew you and liked you as a friend, it wouldn't make the slightest difference whether you were in Albany or in Washington.
But that happened to be, I think, the thing which first made him pay any attention to us. He felt my husband was someone he wanted to know. And so he calmly went about getting to know him.
This is Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, the former First Lady of our land. Both she and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt were friends of Alexander Wolcott, although it wasn't always an easy friendship.
He liked to be your guest, but only if he could have exactly what he wanted. That meant coffee at any hour in the day or night. It meant being able to invite anyone he desired to have breakfast with him in his room, or to have lunch, or to have dinner if he didn't want to have it with you when he happened to be staying with you. He was a very amusing person, a very well-read person, a man of great intellectual interests. He stayed with us a great deal in the White House, evidently liked our guests very often, because he would sometimes announce that he was not going to come down for lunch, but he was having so-and-so, who was staying with us, lunch with him in his room. He did stay with us, and we were not in the White House, in Hyde Park. And he was always not an easy guest, but a pleasant guest. You were willing to take the trouble to give him the things he wanted because you enjoyed having him so much. But you did have to have a good deal of service to meet his needs. He liked to be the center of the stage. Even with the President of the United States, he was still the center of the stage. And I enjoyed him, and so did my husband, more than I can say. I found him a very warm and a very affectionate friend. It was a joyous thing to meet him, and when he died, I really felt a great void in the...
The judge rather sharply, and the judge said to him, "Mr. Darrow, I hope you mean no disrespect of this court." Mr. Darrow...
Motion picture writer.
Charlie McArthur and I played one on him once in his chateau in Lake Bombazine in Vermont. Charlie and I had gone up there to write a movie script called Wuthering Heights, from the novel of that name. And we were in Hyde's favor with Alec, because he presumed that we weren't delicate enough fellows to handle such a job. Present at Wolcott's house at the time was Alice Miller, Noel Coward, Mr. Wolcott, and some other very flossy gentlemen. Charlie and I decided we would have a little fun with Alec about Wuthering Heights, so we wrote two different versions of Wuthering Heights. The one we wanted Alec to see took up Mr. Heathcliff's adventures among the Indians in New York. And we wrote about 15 pages of Heathcliff bargaining with the Indians to buy great areas of territory. And about the third day, Wolcott, who was always snooping, found these 15 pages. And when we arrived at dinner that night, dinner passed in utter silence. Towards the end of the dinner, Mr. Wolcott suggested we leave the island. He refused to entertain two literary igorotes any further. So we pretended to go away, and we solved the matter by showing him the actual script and a poem of mine that he liked in NIAC. The only letters I ever received from him were solicitous inquiries into my disease, which he fancied was going to carry me off any month.
And he was old at the time, and his only success as an actor had been in Dublin. But Alexander Wolcott, with his interest in anything that was going on anywhere, had heard of him. As a result, he was given a chance to tour with Catherine Cornell in Romeo and Juliet in Canada.
I went to New York to Alex's apartment, and a day later he had bamboozled and generally forced poor Miss Catherine Cornell into signing me up, and thus I went back into the theater, and that's how I met him.
The nicest thing about Alex was his capacity for finding people that were tremendously talented and unhailed and uncelebrated.
It might be physically unsafe for the thousands who would be attracted there. And I made a deal with the authorities to wire up the whole town in return for the broadcast privilege, so that the proceedings could be heard in every school, park, and along the city streets. With their permission, I rearranged the courtroom to fit our radio needs. I used one microphone for the table of the prosecution lawyers, one for the defense battery, and put the witness box in front of the judge so that the third mic could pick them up together. I myself shared a windowsill with the writer H.L. Mencken for the commentary and the descriptions of the proceedings. The test case soon became a battle between the fundamentalists and the strict interpreters of the Bible on the one hand, and on the other side, the champions of modern thought, the skeptics, and the factual scientists. To the delight of the hundreds of newspaper reporters, columnists, and photographers from all over the world, it narrowed into a thundering clash between Clarence Darrow, the great defender, and William Jennings Bryan, the greatest orator of his time, three times a candidate for the presidency, and the idol of what Henry Mencken used to call the Bible Belt. At one time, Darrow bellowed that his reason in examining Bryan was to show up fundamentalism and to prevent bigots and ignoramuses from controlling the educational system of the United States. Bryan cried out in his deep, mellow voice that he was fighting to protect the Word of God against the greatest atheist and agnostic in the United States. Oddly enough, Bryan and Darrow didn't look the part at the trial. Bryan was immaculate, even in the intense heat and the shirt sleeves, flapping a palm fan. Clarence Darrow, as he generally did, looked like one of the hill country natives, the unpressed pants, the snapping suspenders, and the drawling voice. Darrow would spend his evenings sitting on the curbstone with the newspaper men. One night he joined us in a stealthy auto ride deep into the mountains to purchase genuine moonshine liquor in gallon crocks. On another evening he crept with Westbrook Pegler, Damon Runyon, myself, and a few others across a meadow to eavesdrop on a frenzied outdoor holy roller religious meeting under the kerosene lamps. Although the sentiment of all the local audience was, of course, with William Jennings Bryan, the show was stolen by Clarence Darrow. On such biblical subjects as Jonah and the whale, the date of the flood, and where Cain got his wife, Darrow badgered Bryan, ridiculed his biblical interpretations, and made him a frightened, befuddled man. I have a picture of the trial here, and there is a look of sheer panic on Bryan's face. After all these years, I still believe that it was Darrow's verbal fencing and relentless examination of Bryan, as much as the July heat and his obesity, that brought on the death of William Jennings Bryan a week or so later, right there in the little town of Dayton, Tennessee, the scene of the so-called monkey trial.
But was it Darrow's verbal sword which brought on Bryan's death? An old friend thinks not. He is Dr. T.V. Smith, a Maxwell professor of poetry, politics, and philosophy at Syracuse University.
On a Sunday, when the court was more or less in recess, Mr. Darrow went up to the mountains to get a breath of fresh air and cool air. Bryan stayed in the bosom of his many devotees around the city. At lunch that day, I've had this vouched for me, Mr. Bryan ate two whole chickens. He drank two quarts of iced tea. He ate a quart of ice cream with all of the fixings that goes with this, including nearly a quart of radishes, peeled radishes that he was very fond of, on an extremely hot day, and in an hour he was dead. I've forgotten what the medical profession assigned as the cause. But when one of the newspaper boys went up to the mountains to break the word to Darrow, he said, Mr. Darrow, so inhumane was your examination of him, cross-examination, he died of a broken heart. Darrow said, broken heart? He died of a busted gut.
That was Darrow, all right. Plain of speech, sometimes painfully plain. And that commonness, if so you can label it, was his stock in trade as a lawyer. Another attorney, another Chicagoan, appraises his courtroom technique. Here is James Daniels.
I remember distinctly. It was during what we called in those days, I think, the communist trial. I think Bross Lloyd was one of the defendants. And they had assigned a special prosecutor, a man named Comerford, who subsequently became a judge. He was a white-haired boy of the Democratic Party and well, he was meticulous in his dress and speech to the point that some people might even call him foppish. And if there was ever a contrast between two men, especially in the same arena, it was between, say, Joe. He said to him, he said, did you ever have occasion prior to this litigation, to come across any periodicals or propaganda dealing with this particular issue? And the juror, simple man, looked at him a little bit in amazement, and finally Comerford dropped him, and Darrow took over the examination. The first question he asked him was such a vivid contrast. He said, Joe, he said, did you read anything in the paper about this thing? He said, do you ever talk to anybody about it? And Joe said, yes. And he says, is it going to make it tougher for me, he says, to try this case because you read something? And Joe said, no. Well, it was an extreme in an address. Darrow was, and I don't know if any of his biographers ever paid particular note to this, possibly have, but he was almost a worshiper of the Saxon in English. He spoke an English that anybody could understand, and yet it was a good English. I might say he had the Esperanto of English. It was a universal language.
Clarence Darrow made considerable use of that Saxon English as a lecturer, a debater. He was unexcelled. He was a free thinker, a dissenter, a liberal, and he never ran from an interesting subject. His love for talk was almost an all-consuming passion. Professor Smith remembers his platform appearances well. The professor was on the other side.
We met each other in the course of a debate in the city of Chicago when I think somebody else had failed him as a foil for raising money for a good cause, which he was always engaged in. And I was dragged in at the last moment to be the Christian before the lion, let him eat me up to the delectation of the crowd. I shall never forget the occasion, largely because it served as an introduction to one of the greatest men, and surely one of the kindest men that I've ever known. Mr. Darrow was in the habit of debating with preachers and priests and rabbis against religion. And he wanted to debate with me the question against the freedom of the human will. Well, I hardly knew whether a man had a will, much less whether it was free or not, so I didn't want to get engaged in that debate with the old lion. I told him finally in a happy conversation with him, I said, Darrow, I'm willing to debate this proposition. Can the individual control his conduct? He thought about that for a long time. He said, well, that sounds to me like the same old thing, that whether the individual will is free or not. Well, I said, it doesn't mean the same thing to me, and I'd sort of like to have it stated in this way. Well, he said, all right, that's perfectly all right. So we went down to theater on Sunday afternoon with the streets all roped off because thousands of people came to see the old lion eat up anybody in sight. And I spoke first, affirming that the individual can control his conduct. Well, in those days, I was full of behavioristic psychology and some of the new wrinkles of academic life, and Mr. Darrow didn't make a point to keeping up with all of these fads and foibles. He just had an established line that went back as far as the ancient Greeks. So I got up and I said that I knew that some men could control other men's conduct, and I knew that from the example of Mr. Darrow, that he was unusually good at controlling the conduct of jurors. I said he's been boasting to me about some of the great cases he had. He boasts that he never has lost a case, at least not in the sense of having the defendant sent to the electric chair. I said he's explained to me also, perhaps he'll not be giving away his secrets, as to how he manages to control the conduct of jurors so as to get them to give the decision he wants. He has a theory that nobody would ever hang a friend. Almost anybody would hang an enemy. And a stranger is always an enemy. So if you can stretch out cases long enough until the jury gets acquainted with every lineament of the face of the defendant, especially if you can drag his wife and children into court, where you get something of the family profile, you get to where you feel that he's an old friend, you know him all over, you know, and you simply can't hang him. So he said, I drag out the cases as long as I possibly can to establish a rapport between the juror and the defendant. If But he said, I'm awfully careful about choosing the jurors also. Then he launched into an exposition of the consequences of different religions and sects. I don't vouch for this. I'm only repeating what he told me. He said that you ought never to take a Presbyterian on a jury because Presbyterians are Calvinists. They believe in a God that will send infants to eternal damnation, a very hard and austere God. And he said they try to be like their God as nearly as they can. So don't ever take a Presbyterian if you're selecting a jury. He said you can take a Baptist. They usually aren't so intelligent and so set in their ways. And they have a somewhat more just and benevolent God. But he said among the Protestant sects, it's much better to take a Methodist. He said you can get them to laughing or crying. You get them to do almost anything. They'll do the humane thing and call it doing the will of God. But he said, above all religious people, since there aren't enough free thinkers to make up juries, I'd prefer them because they're very rational, he went on to say. A Roman Catholic is far and away the best. Said a Roman Catholic can go on and do what seems merciful to him and get the church to excuse him if he's made any foible through confession. He said, they're awfully good jurors. I take Roman Catholics when I can. Well, this debate, I went on to say that Mr. Darrow controls other men's conduct. You see that he does. He's proud of it. He boasts about it. Now, if I could show that he can control his own conduct through exactly the same technique he controls other people's conduct, I think I would have won the debate. And I said, that is really exactly what happens. We're built in a curious fashion. We're built with ears on one side of the head and a mouth on the other, so that our own ears hear what our own mouths say. I said, we talk to ourselves. In fact, thinking is only the conversation of the soul with herself, as the great Greek philosopher Plato said. Now, I said, for instance, Mr. Darrow will be at the city of Detroit in the morning, this was Sunday afternoon, at 10 o'clock. How do I know? Well, he told me he was going to defend this Negro that shot into a white mob in defense of his home. But it wasn't merely that he told me, he told himself. He promised himself 6 weeks ago that tomorrow at 10 o'clock he'd be in the city of Detroit. I said, he will be there, you watch it, and he'll be there because he told himself that he was going to be there. I said, he's controlling his own conduct in exactly the same way he controls other people's conduct by talking to himself. Mr. Darrow was sitting back crossing and uncrossing his legs because this was somewhat new line to the old boy. He got up to speak. He said something like this. He said, ladies and gentlemen, I enjoyed that speech very much, though I was a good deal embarrassed by it. He said, I never heard that speech before. He said, if I had 2 or 3 weeks to think it over, I think I might have something to say in reply. But he said, I ain't got 2 or 3 weeks to think it over. I got to talk, and I got to talk right now. So he said, I'll just go on and make my old speech against the freedom of the will. Well, this was the subject I'd refused to debate with him, but this is what the crowd was looking for. They rose up and gave him a complete ovation, and anything he said from there on was counted in his favor. It didn't make any difference what I said. The debate was already lost.
Roger Baldwin also recalls Darrow, the lecturer.
I heard him in one debate, and a debate which he very frequently used, entitled Is Life Worth Living? Mr. Darrow took the position that life was not worth living. And of course, every clergyman he debated took the position that it was worth living. Mr. Darrow's general line was that you couldn't figure out any purpose in life, that it was all pretty futile, and that we each of us lived only because of the satisfactions and pleasures that we managed to get out of our enthusiasms and our interests. And he had a little story he used to illustrate it with, in which he said that he had learned by his own long experience that you could only live happily if you doped yourself, as he said. Doped yourself with some enthusiasm, some interest, which transcended the business of daily living. He said he'd tried all the different kinds of dope himself and they hadn't worked. He'd tried religion and socialism and women, and he says none of them really got him anywhere. But then he found one that did. Hard work. He said, the right thing to do was to get a hold of something and work so hard at it that you forgot you were living, and then you were just as well off as if you were dead. Well, this witty and cynical line, of course, got audiences, and it also got his opponents confused. It was a hard line to beat. He enjoyed this. He enjoyed it so much that it really contradicted his own notion that life wasn't worth living. I heard him make another speech during the prosperity days of the late 1920s, when he ridiculed the attitude of the American working class, who then were not particularly in favor of working class action or even of trade unionism. The unions were slipping. And he said, the trouble with the American working man today is that he owns an automobile and one share of oil stock, and he doesn't know whether he wants the price of gas to go up or down.
This passion for debate was never confined to the formal lecture platforms. Slim Brundage, proprietor of Chicago's College of Complexes, a later stronghold of free thinking, has other recollections.
When I first came to Chicago, I was an habitué of the Bug Club, which would attract up to 3,000 people to listen to speeches in Washington Park on a Sunday afternoon. During World War I, the city fathers decided there were too many German sympathizers and ordered it disbanded. In those days, there were those who thought free speech was worth fighting for. Being one of the Bugs, Clarence Darrow signed a petition demanding an injunction against the police department from stopping the meetings of the Bug Club. Darrow was the first signature. 15,000 people signed it after him. The order against free speech was rescinded, and I became a Bug in 1923. Hadn't been for Darrow, there'd probably never been any Bug Club. You can get out of the books most of the things he accomplished. What kind of a man he was can only be told by the reaction other people had to him. He had never lost the common Dutch. His homely face would light up with a kindly smile when approached by even humblest people. Every year, Darrow was invited to be the guest of honor at the Walt Whitman dinner. One time he was called upon to talk. When he was called upon to talk, he said, "You know, I've been coming to these dinners for years. Finally, I decided I'd take a night off and read Leaves of Grass. Folks, my conclusion after a careful perusal was that Whitman wasn't a poet. Now, here's my idea of a real poet." He held up a thin volume of The Shropshire Lad by A.E. Houseman. In his defense of Leopold and Loeb, he quoted Houseman twice. Immediately upon reading the verses in the papers, I rushed out and bought a book. Those verses, let's see. "Now hollow fires burn out to black, and lights are guttering low. Square your shoulders, lift your pack, and leave your friends and go. Oh, never fear, man, naught's to dread. Look not left nor right. In all the endless road you tread, there's nothing but tonight."
Darrow's quick mind, his ability to debate simply the most complicated of subjects, is remembered well by another debater of note, by another dissenter of note. Here is Norman Thomas.
His brilliance was devoted to showing why a man was not guilty, why a conventionally accepted belief was not true. An episode in my own experience illustrates that point. Charles Evans Hughes, then Secretary of State, had approved a protocol by which the United States would join the World Court. The issue was controversial, and I found myself presiding over a debate on it in Carnegie Hall between Clarence Darrow and the very able socialist lawyer, Morris Hilquin. We were chatting amiably in the anteroom when the head usher informed us that it was time to go on the stage. Only then did Darrow say to me in a stage whisper, "Norman, have you got a copy of the protocol?" I said, "No, not with me." "Does that mean you haven't read it?" "Yes," said he. "How then," I asked, "are you going to debate it?" "Trust me," he answered, "I can debate any question in the negative." And he did. Not as brilliantly as his opponent, but his argument was of the sort that kept the Senate from ratifying the protocol. Darrow's negativism, however, often had positive results for justice. I was close to him in only one of his famous cases. Shortly after Mussolini came to power, he encouraged the organization of black shirts in Italian districts in New York. That fascinating character, Carlo Tresca, more than any other man, saved us from them. One Memorial Day in the Bronx, two local leaders of the Black Shirts were shot down in cold blood on their way to a parade. There was no immediate arrest, but eventually Greco and Carrillo, well-known anti-fascists, were arrested. Carlo Tresca formed a United Front committee to defend them. The committee wanted Darrow as lawyer. Arthur Garfield Hayes and Vito Marc Antonio, then a rising young man in Fiorello LaGuardia's office, offered their help. I was told to approach Darrow, and if memory serves me, did it by telephone with Tresca at my back. Darrow said he would have to ask a $10,000 fee. Since we were depending largely on nickels and dimes from the poor, I hesitated. But Tresca literally shoved me in the back and ordered me to say yes. I did, and Darrow took over. The prosecution had an extremely weak case, and a lesser man than Darrow might have won. His victory was triumphant. We had managed to pay all the other bills, but had nothing in the treasury for his fee, and I saw small chance of raising it. Heavy was my gloom, despite our victory. Again, Tresca saved the day. He said, "Tonight we'll go to that party at Art Hayes. You wait for the right moment and tell Clarence how things stand. He's proud of his victory, and I'm sure he'll forget the fee." Once more, I obeyed with inner fear and trembling. But Tresca was a good prophet. Darrow generously forgave the debt. It was like the big-hearted lawyer, whose skepticism about mankind was great.
Darrow the lawyer, and in Chicago, there still exists a law firm carrying his name, Darrow, Smith, and Carlin. A former partner, and he had many in his career, talks of the man. Here is William L. Carlin.
I started to work for Mr. Darrow as an office boy, relieving an office boy regularly employed in the summer of 1902. You immediately knew that you were in the presence of a great man when you were in his presence. Something about his face, something about his manner of approach to you, he made you feel at home. He wanted to be your friend. It was the most unorthodox law office ever in this town. He was interested only to have you there if there was work to do. If there wasn't work to do, he were at perfect liberty to leave. He had no rules. He always had time to talk to anyone that came in the office. He never shuttled them off to someone in the office. For instance, during the Loeb and Leopold trial, when he had a great many things in his mind by reason of that trial, yet when anyone came in to see him during that trial, he had time to see him at the noon hour, or he would take them over to the courthouse with him and discuss their problems on his way to court. So he was a liberal in his thinking. He was a liberal all the way through. He was against politicians. He was strictly for the man who was a liberal, not his party. He was against politics. He was a homely man in the sense that if you're looking for a good-looking man. But he was a fine-looking man if you were looking for a man of character. His face was lined with character. He was a very sloppy dresser. Mrs. Darrow had all she could do to get him to go to the tailor to get a suit. He refused to wear dress suits or tuxedos unless he absolutely had to. He'd get a shine every 6 months. The barber used to kid him about that. The colored boy had talked about getting a shine. He was, "I'm not due until Christmas. This would be in July." And he wouldn't care much about how his tie looked or how his hair was. He used to comb his hair with a towel. He'd be going to make a speech, a banquet, and he'd take one look in the looking glass and he'd get his hands wet and plastered down and say, "How do I look?" And out he'd go, without a shoe shine. I say that he was a great, simple man who fought for the rights of the poor and the oppressed. He was always for the poor. He was a crusader, I often say it, and I keep on saying it, for freedom, which I think in this day and age is a very necessary thing. the thing that impressed me a great deal was the fact that he always had time for other people and their troubles.
To today's generation, Clarence Darrow is perhaps best remembered for the monkey trial in Tennessee or the Loeb Leopold murder case. Too few perhaps know of his earlier and possibly greater successes. As a young man, he defended trade unionism. In those days, a phrase akin to a dirty word. In California lives author Irving Stone, writer of the biography, Clarence Darrow for the defense. Stone, in his exhaustive research, has captured those difficult and productive hours in the life of Darrow. There was the defense of Eugene Debs, for example, and Irving Stone tells about it now.
It's pretty commonly agreed that Clarence Darrow is America's greatest labor lawyer. But what is not so well known is that Darrow gave up a highly remunerative job as legal counsel for the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad in order to defend Eugene V. Debs, who was a total stranger to him, when Debs founded the American Railway Union and took that union out on strike against Pullman, who had created one of the most tragic and deeply suffered labor situations America had ever known. Now, Darrow was a liberal, a man who had been brought up on the great books and the great thinkers, and he was a fighter. Yet he was also a man who believed in nonviolence. But he believed at this point that the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad was attempting violence against the working people of America because the railroad had gotten out an injunction which made it not only illegal for a man to strike in America, but actually a prison offense, an offense for which Eugene V. Debs was at this moment in jail. When Darrow walked out of his job to defend the labor union, he changed his entire life, and he also changed the entire life of America. It was Darrow's idea that a man who worked for a living was entitled to a good wage and was entitled to the protection of his job and was entitled to consort with his own working men, his own fellow workers, in order to better their own position in life. Darrow, when he went into this trial, lost not only his job, but all of most of his friends and all of his sympathizers in Chicago. He helped the American Railway Union not win the strike, but gain certain concessions from Pullman. But at the end of that time, though he had helped labor considerably, he was out of a job, he was broke, he had no one to turn to because he was now thought of as a radical. This was the beginning of his great career, and it was the beginning of his place in defending labor.
And the heartbreaking McNamara case.
In the entire story of the conflict between labor and management in this country, there's no case so tragic as the bombing of the Los Angeles Times building in 1911. At this time, Los Angeles was called the worst open shop city in America. Controlled by the Los Angeles Times and by the Merchants and Manufacturers Association, no union was allowed to form, no company was allowed to let a union member work for it, or it had its credit cut off and its customers kept away from it. In an effort to put unions into Los Angeles, the steel workers sent in a number of organizers and violence began at once. At this point, the McNamara brothers were sent into Los Angeles to put a bomb in part of the Los Angeles Times building to cause an explosion in the mistaken and forlorn idea that this could frighten the people of Los Angeles into letting the unions in. The tragedy arose when the bomb explosion caused a gas line to blow up the entire Los Angeles Times building and to kill 20 innocent working men. In order to have the best possible defense for the McNamara brothers, unions called in Clarence Darrow once again because he was the greatest defender labor had in America. Darrow did not want to come. He wanted to build up his practice. He was not well. And yet labor said, you must come into this trial or you will convict the McNamaras of being guilty. Darrow came to Los Angeles on the assumption that his clients were innocent. But in his investigations, he found that they were indeed guilty of setting off the bomb. And he thereupon caused almost an upheaval in America by insisting that the men had to plead guilty to the crime and take their punishment. The union said that he had been a traitor, but Darrow did not approve of violence, and he said to the American people, we will plead those innocent who are innocent, But those who have committed this kind of crime, we will throw on the mercy of the courts. He did so in a speech which the entire nation listened to, telling them of the wrongs that had been committed against labor, but by the same token telling labor that they must not commit crimes or illegal acts, that they must work in peace and in harmony with management to achieve the ends that labor and management both want and need so desperately in this country. The McNamaras were given life sentences, the older of the two being pardoned after a great many years, the younger brother dying in prison. Darrow himself was then arrested and tried for subornation of perjury, tried not once but twice by the same forces that wanted to keep union and organized labor out of Los Angeles. He very nearly had to go to the penitentiary for the rest of his life, but his brilliant pleas for the men he had defended, for the poor, for the weak, for the downtrodden, for those who desperately needed a voice, earned him an acquittal by both juries in the both trials.
The McNamara trial showed, as did a great many of his other cases, that Darrow detested the thought of capital punishment. But even that distaste was not without a tinge of Darrow humor. Again, Roger Baldwin of the Civil Liberties Union.
Darrow is a lifelong opponent of capital punishment, and I believe for some years headed a national association to abolish capital punishment. He was always against the death penalty, of course, in the cases which he defended, but he was also against it on principle. I once went with him to Washington when he testified before some committee of Congress, which had a bill abolishing capital punishment, I believe, in the federal jurisdiction. And I remember one remark he made, which was certainly the key to his attitude and certainly impressed the congressman. He said, "I never wanted to kill any man myself, and I don't think the state ought to kill any man either. But I must admit," he said, "I've read a good many obituary notices with great satisfaction."
And Darrow possessed that same sort of humor about something else he disliked. And Professor Smith recalls that humor as applied to religion.
He came up to my office one day when I was in Congress. But back at home, the city of Chicago, his old face, weather-beaten as it was, just simply beaming with joy. I said, "Clarence, you must have got news that some wealthy uncle died and left you a legacy. I never saw you look so happy." "No," he said, "not that, but thing next to that," said, "I made a discovery last night that gives me more pleasure than anything I've discovered in my life." I said, "What in the world could this be?" But he said, "You know, I've always been against religion." I said, "Yes, I know you have, but all I ever observed that the consequences was that you fell in love with every priest, preacher, and rabbi you ever debated with, and you love Christians till I think you're more Christian than they are."